Welcome to the latest edition of the Positive Populist Podcast. Guess who our guest is today? It's so exciting.
A lot of alliteration there.
I know, but it's very positive populist podcast. So look who it is. You could tell it's Raymond Arroyo. You see him on air with Laura Ingraham.
And today he is in the you can hear him.
Hear him and hear his brilliance.
Oh, please. Don't oversell. This is going to drive the audience away.
Exactly right. I'm going to start with a question I ask all my guests. Are you, Raymond Arroyo, a positive populist?
I am a positive populist in the sense that, one, I'm going to qualify this a little bit. Since I was in college, I was a huge fan of Alexander Hamilton before the musical, then the, you know, which I'm not a huge fan of. I like some of the songs, but the history's a little cloudy. And the thing I love about Hamilton is he was a bit distrustful of the mob mentality.
Right.
And they built safeguards into the Constitution and our whole republic to ensure that whereas you need to have the freedom for the people to allow their will to be expressed, you didn't want it running amok, so to speak. Yeah, there had to be guardrails. So, yes, I'm very positive.
See, this is why the brilliance is already apparent to everyone.
Please.
Because normally, you see, I ask that question. You say, yes, I'm a positive. And then I say, okay, well, tell me, what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
How do you? And you've already gone way. Well, you've already sort of given your own interpretation. But I'd love you to sort of tell us, I mean, Alexander, so how old were you when you were into Alexander?
Oh, I don't know, 19 or 20. I have all of his, I'm probably the only person who has all of the collected, Columbia University put out every document, every legal document, every letter, Hamilton. It's like a 40-volume set, and I bought them. I worked at then, NYU, and I would buy them then.
Wow.
So I kept the collection. I still have it.
God, how interesting.
But the thing I loved about Hamilton is he saw, obviously, he was willing to lay down his life for this revolution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're the next revolution man. But he was also forward-looking enough to realize if we lost the moral center, which all the founding fathers are unanimous in this, that the Constitution was founded for what they called, not me, what they called a moral people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll let others figure out what that means.
Yes.
But to my mind, it means you have a certain agreement about what it is we hold dear and the values and principles that are our own and worth protecting and dying for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure today that there is that kind of unanimity of morality, spirit, mindset.
Mm-hmm.
That is what Hamilton worried about. Jay worried about it. Madison worried about it. And in the crafting of the Constitution, they built in safeguards. I like some of those safeguards. At the same time, for too long in our recent political memory, the true voice of the people and their desire has been squashed by lousy leadership, people who ran on one thing and then governed a separate way.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, this populist uprising has the spirit of 1776 about it, and I like that.
So you know who you're reminding me of right now?
No.
I'm not sure you'll take this as a compliment. Who knows? We'll find
thanks.
Out. Someone I saw speak recently at the Iowa State Fair, one of the presidential candidates.
Beto O'Rourke. Oh,
no,
thank you.
I would never do that to you.
His teeth are much better and hair a lot better than mine.
I would never do that to you. Actually, Marianne Williamson. Because she, you know, I knew. Okay, he didn't take it as a compliment. But I tell you why. Because she talked about a couple of things that struck a chord there.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about this spiritual sense of what America's all about, which was,
well,
I think is very interesting. Okay, maybe a different sense of it, but not just policy and what I'm going to do on healthcare and whatever. She said something a bit deeper.
Yes.
And she also made that comparison to 1776 and what that was all about and how this idea needs to be renewed and fought for. And I don't know, there's something about the way you're talking that
we both have. I think we both. I'll tell you where I think there is convergence. Marianne Williamson does have a cultural take on politics, which is where I live.
That's right.
Culture is far more important than politics. Culture governs politics. It's way upstream. Politics is it's the bottom feeder of the culture.
Right.
It's at the very bottom. It's the last thing that's affected.
Yes.
So she's right in that sense. Where I would disagree with her is the foundational ethics, principles, and values, morality, that the founding fathers were fighting for was very well defined, at times very rigidly mm-hmm. defined in their era. Mm-hmm. Marianne is off on some tangent. You can go to some, you know, a kibbutz, or you can go to a yogi, or you can go to the woods or commune with the tree in your backyard. It's all the same in her mind. I disagree with that.
Okay.
I think there is a hierarchy and a historically verifiable trajectory of what comes from a certain vision mm-hmm. and what.
Yes, it's more. It's intellectually rooted in a way that I think that you.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk about her.
Christianity.
Although I do think.
I mean, look, the Judeo-Christian vision for humanity gave birth to what we live in today in many ways, and its folly and its corruption.
Yes. Okay, listen.
Okay.
I think we can agree. You know, she's certainly interesting. I'm more interesting than the other
one. No, she's fascinating. I think like she's hilarious.
But I want to go back to Raymond, age 19, with all that Hamilton interest. And I was just curious when you said that. Was that a moment when you started, or even before that, had you been interested in political ideas and all that? And where did it all come from? Where was your interest sparked?
I'll tell you how that interest was sparked. My background is really in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to NYU at mm-hmm. this time, mm-hmm.
Young to be going there, isn't it?
No, yeah. 18. I graduated and went
at 19
to college.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I was just thinking, yeah, because I took a year. Oh, okay, go on.
Yeah,
so NYU.
I'm at NYU.
Yeah.
Studying with a Stella Adler, who was sort of the last of the theatrical giants. She was the woman who trained Marlon Brando.
What were you studying?
I was studying theater. I was an actor.
Right.
Studying theater.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, I was majoring in political science as well as journalism.
That's
and now I use all of my all of
that's
my skills an, I deploy.
That's such an interesting combination.
Well, the interest in Hamilton actually came from a theatrical uh-huh. understanding, because I happened to come across a biography of him. And here's a guy, he has an affair.
Mm-hmm.
He was caused a celeb. They tried to take him down over this very public, embarrassing affair.
Mm-hmm.
He was Washington's aide-de-camp during the Revolution, the first secretary of the economy, created the credit. That's what here. And so all of that I found fascinating. This conflicted character has the duel with Aaron Burr over his honor being besmirched by this guy who was a friend of his at one time.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, I was fascinated by his character and wanted to learn more.
Interesting.
And as I dug in, there's some things in his political philosophy I deeply disagree with. But the fascination here was, how do you get these fractious colonies to come together? What unites them? Here we're back to that question again.
Yeah.
And as we enter this next revolution,
mm-hmm.
this populist revolution mm-hmm. that you keep talking about, we need to figure out what unites us. Hamilton was very canny, and he stood back and said, well, they have different manners. They have very different lifestyles, these mm-hmm. people. They mm-hmm. don't even eat the same things. They don't dance the same way. What unites them? Debt. They all have debt. So we're going to consolidate the debt in the federal government, and we'll hold all of them captive. That was his, innovation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The federal bank, the national bank. He was a charismatic figure, by the way. The only reason we have the Constitution, the only reason the Constitution was approved was because of Hamilton's great oratory, uh-huh. convincing oratory, and theatricality. I mean, the man staged a parade outside the window that they thought was spontaneous, but he actually staged it the Constitutional Convention through the window. Look, you can hear the voices of liberty. Da, 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 da. Look at them. We have to respond. All of that, you know, that's
I didn't know
a showman.
That's brilliant.
He's a showman. But he also made a lot of political enemies.
Yeah.
He was hated and didn't know. He wasn't really at heart a politician, but a brilliant visionary and a man who was dead by 40.
So when you're at NYU doing all this and you've got all this, you know, bubbling up, did you have a sense then that you wanted to pursue all three of those things, the theater, the politics, the journalism, or was one more, you know, how did you balance all that out?
I see it all as a pursuit of truth. And Stella Adler, who was my mentor. And she was 90 when I studied with her. But she was sharp as a tack. She would brutalize you. You'd get up in front of her to do a scene.
Yeah.
And she would literally brutalize everything about the performance.
Really? What, very direct. Personal.
Oh, you'd walk through the door and she'd go, "Stop, darling." And I'd say, what happened? "You don't believe you're in this apartment, do you? You enter like a phony actor. Go out. I don't believe you're a businessman. I don't believe it's the end of the day. I don't believe you're tired. I don't believe you were recently divorced. Go. Do it again."
Wow.
Every moment was scrutinized. But it was a kind of theatrical boot camp. If you could live through that, and I did.
Yeah.
There were only a handful of us that graduated at the end, as opposed to those who came in.
Right.
But it was a great training. But she always said, your job as an actor, and I consider this still my job today,
mm-hmm.
your job is to raise up humanity and remind it of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Show it the best it can be and the worst. That's what the theater should do.
Yeah.
It's a platform for humanity. And its function is very important because it reminds us of who we are on our best days and on our worst. So we're on guard against both. Sadly, so many of my friends, even in this town, in L.A., have forgotten that. They don't. It's all about ratings and box office. And, and that's fine. You need that, too. But to lose a mission, a sense of mission, I think, is a terrible thing. Money's never enough. That's not a mission.
And so what did you – is that what you focused on first then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I was an actor. I acted. I directed. I worked in New York and London. I toured.
Uh-huh. What kind of
– Everything. I did Shakespeare. I did Racine. I did Molière. I did musicals.
Racine and Molière. Okay. So this is – so the other – is Bajazet, is that one of the plays? Who did that?
Was
that
no,
I remember I had to learn this when I was studying French.
Yeah, now you're
and we were talking
French
about
not my strong
Molière. Suit. Not Molière, he was the later. What was the Racine? It was Racine.
Racine.
That's right.
Probably Racine.
That's right. Because we were talking about these old French plays. And
it was
based on a Greek.
The Phaedo farces.
And it was based on Greek. And so I said, no, that was Greek. You know what? I don't know that it was Greek. All I remember is having to read it and I was studying French.
Yeah, well, it's a... Again, all of that. So all that's rattling.
Oh, wow, you did. So you were, and you producing as well.
I was directing. Producing. But okay. I tell you what happened after when you go on tour and you're doing the same thing month after month, week after week. That intellectually got really boring for me. I did. It wasn't a challenge. And the truth of the matter is, after 3 weeks, if you're a decent actor, you've squeezed all you're going to out of that role. There's nothing else to discover. Right. So then it becomes an act of revival and, you know, reanimating what was.
Yeah.
And you want to keep it in the moment, but that's very difficult after all that time. I mean, but Marlon Brando hated theater. He never did theater again after Streetcar Named Desire, where he made his name. I see why. I get it. I mean, that's why these people are heroic. When you see somebody like, you know, a Yul Brynner or a Carol Channing doing 5,000 performances of a role over decades, this is not a theatrical event. This deserves a medal because I mean, and to keep it fresh, that takes real. That's someone who's either very, very just brain dead or someone who is just so committed to their craft and their audience that they.
So did you just stop?
I stopped. I stopped.
When
I went, in the early 2000s at some point, perhaps. And I went to work at the Associated Press.
Oh, so now you switched to the journalism.
I went to journalism.
How interesting.
Yeah. Well, I was always writing throughout this whole time. I was doing theater reviews. I was doing that sort of thing. And I segued into the AP, and I was doing everything I could get my hands on.
Based in the
in
US?
New York.
In New York.
In New York, at the AP, the right in Rockefeller Center.
So were you a reporter, like a beat reporter?
Well,
you were going
no.
out and covering stories.
I did stories. I did reviews. I did anything they would let me do. And there were the kind of deans of Jack Capon and guys like that who had covered World War II, Vietnam.
Yeah.
Who were the editors, and they would shred your copy.
Right.
They were just great wordsmiths, and they loved the word.
It's very important. Having someone who can really rigorously sort of tell you about good writing, I think, is just so important.
Yeah,
it's such a gift. I had that my first job at university. It was totally political. It was at the Conservative Party in the UK, and I remember this. It literally made me cry. This brilliant man, actually, who was the deputy director of the it's called the research department, and it was seen as this kind of, you know, David Cameron was there and George, all these people that ended up, you know, we all sort of made progress in politics in the UK. My wife Rachel was there, and I had just come out of Oxford and I thought I was so clever and I knew all this stuff. And I was asked to write a pamphlet. Margaret Thatcher was still prime minister the last year or so of her time as prime minister. And I was one of her great achievements was the privatization program.
Right.
And I was the desk officer for trade and industry and energy. So it was in my, and they said, we want to do a pamphlet on privatization, like, you know, this incredible British success story. So write this pamphlet. And they gave me a rough kind of page anyway. And I wrote this thing. And I was so proud of it. And I thought it was so clever and brilliant. And I'd studied economics and it was, and I handed it in. And this guy, just a bit like Stella, had just absolutely ripped it. Just like, this is incomprehensible. What does this mean? No one's going to understand. This is full of jargon, you know, like on and on. And it was just one of the best things that ever happened to me. It was brilliant.
Those experiences, if you can kind of swallow the pain and learn from it, you grow enormously.
Still, I mean, you know, whatever. God, 30 years ago.
Right. And you remember
It literally made me cry. And I just thought, oh, God. But it was brilliant.
Yeah. No, you need, I do think you need those moments. And young people, They're much more sensitive than we were. Let's admit it. And even young people I encounter, I try to do the same thing and mentor them and help them through those things because it's up to us to pass what little we've learned on to them.
Yes.
But the reception is interesting. It's not personal. You want to help them better what they're doing. And so I had great mentors at the AP. Then I went to work for Evans and Novak, Robert Novak and Raleigh Evans.
Who They're the famous film reviewers, weren't they?
No. They were the deans of the Washington Press Corps. Bob
so
Novak.
Who am I thinking of?
You're thinking of Ebert and someone else. Siskel and
it
Ebert.
It was a pair of
Siskel and Ebert. No,
my excuse is I didn't live here then, so I didn't know anything.
You get the British dispensation, right? But Bob Novak and Raleigh Evans were Chicago Sun-Times columnists.
Right.
Their column was devoured by Washington, made huge news. Uh-huh. And I was the reporter for the column. So I would go out at that time, pre-internet, and have to go to the morgue at the Washington Post or interview background sources, sometimes primary sources, bring that back for the column, and I'd help them write.
By the way, that itself is such an interesting thing. I mean, people with these big—I've met people, you know, a number of people now who have been the, you know, the researcher for the columns, the reporter, but, and it's really different to the in the U. There's just no such thing, you know, when they're the columnists in the UK, they just sort of dash off their thing before going to the pub. I slightly joke, but
I know it's
a serious business for these serious, you know, the really respected columnists.
Well, there are columnists who are just opinion writers.
Yeah.
Evans and Novak were actually shoe leather reporters who would dig down into, and they had great sources in the government. Mm-hmm. Bob Novak taught me how to work over sources, how you lay the groundwork, how you play them off against each other. Mm-hmm. He was brilliant at that. And he was at the same time producing and headlining Crossfire at CNN, as well as Evans and Novak and a show called Capital Gang. He was doing three shows a week and the column at the same time.
Wow.
He's an amazing man. He was an amazing guy. He's deceased, but he turned into a great friend.
Yeah.
And was one of my.
So how long did you do that for?
Oh, I don't know. A couple of years. Uh-huh. And then I segued into, I became a congressional correspondent out of that.
When?
And at CBN.
Oh.
Or at the Christian Broadcasting Network. And I was their congressional correspondent. And then from there, I went to EWTN, where I still have a show.
Yeah.
And started that show, which is an international news magazine. I have directors, actors, the heads of state, politicians, presidents. And we get into everything from politics to culture to faith and kind of cover that whole space. And we have long conversations.
Right.
I mean, I can do a half hour with a guest and we have the time to do it, which I love.
No, that's exactly right. That's why this is such a pleasure to be able
it
to
is.
Do this.
Yeah.
A lot of the people listening will be familiar with you through your work with Laura.
Right.
On Fox News Channel.
Correct.
So tell us about that, how that connection happened.
Laura and I did a book in 2005, a biography, and Laura had me on her radio show.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of those things, I've had it happen a few times in my life, where you're with someone and there's just a crackle in the air and the chemistry. It's chemistry.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, my friend Jerry Lewis, who was a friend, used to say the first time he met Dean Martin, it was like it was at the end.
Uh-huh.
It was the same. Uh-huh. There was something there that they just fit. And you bring something out of that person, and they bring something out of you that other pairings don't capture.
Yeah. It's very interesting, that whole – sorry, I'm just sort of interrupting the story, but the notion of creative partnerships like that, and pairs, is really interesting. And you know, I was reading something about Lennon and McCartney and that whole – you know, the importance of that, and how even when they really did do it on their own, they would never allow that to be – you presented corrupted. As a single, so it's right. always the two of them, because they knew that really it was the
it was
two of
the bond.
Even if
yeah,
in
was,
the end one of them
right.
did it.
Yeah. And it comes from mutual respect,
yeah.
friendship, and ultimately, you know this, you do this every day. It's a tightrope walk at times. Mm. You don't know where you're going. Mm. So you're trusting this other person will catch you if you fall and pick up the cue, and it usually happens. So
with Laurie, did you? So that so
I was on the radio show after
you on
that, all
you,
the time.
Oh, I see. Right.
She would invite me back. My 10-minute interview with her about the book went mm-hmm. on for 45 minutes.
Right.
We started talking about all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Then she invited me back on the show, and then yes. I became a regular on her radio show.
Right.
And in 2007, maybe years all smashed together in my head. I can never remember right. years. I'm so bad. I told you I stopped the theater in the 2000s. It wasn't. I stopped in 1994 or uh-huh. three. It had to be in that area, which almost a decade earlier,
right.
because I was married in 94 and I was already out of the theater.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, I think it was 2007. Roger Ailes asked Laura and I to do a show. And we did it at 5 uh-huh. o'clock as a fill-in show
right.
on Fox.
Right.
I don't think I've ever told this story before. It was called Just In.
Uh-huh.
And it was we had a great time. We did it for 3 weeks. They asked us to do the show. Laura had just adopted her first daughter.
Yeah.
And I was worried we wouldn't have the time for a daily show at 5 o'clock. She was still doing the radio show every day. And we told them no. We turned them down.
Interesting.
And then more than 10 years later,
yeah,
it circled back around, and they asked her to do the show, and she asked me if I would come along for the ride, and I did.
So you're now there. I mean, we see you on screen.
Yes.
Twice a week, isn't it?
Twice a week, sometimes more. Like this week, it'll be more, because I'm out reporting. And you know,
But you're very much partners in putting it together, aren't you?
That's yes, how it, I can't even remember what the title is, but it's something, I don't know, editorial something. But I help the executive producer and Laura shape the show. But we generate a lot of the core ideas and the framing of the segments. The hardest thing in this is not the topic. Topics are easy.
Yeah.
How do you frame it? And you have a 3-minute window to frame it in, or a 4-minute window.
Yes.
The audience can only absorb one or two ideas in that little window, and you can only explore that much time. So how do you lick this?
Yes.
And what do you open with, and how do you hold their attention? And because of my theatrical training and my writing,
yeah,
I'm very attentive. I don't believe the audience has an obligation to listen to me or Laura or anybody.
Yes.
We have to buy that right and earn that right and arrest their attention. And for that, you have to build in – you have to keep them wanting more. You have to build suspense. Yes. You have to give them surprises. You have to turn ideas on them at times so that they – are engaged. And that's a challenge.
No, no, absolutely.
That's the hardest
part. That's the craft of it. But in terms of going back to actually to where we started with the because I think of Laura very much as one of the original advocates of the popular and you know, leaders of the populist movement that we now see and has been for years.
Yes.
You know, we'll put sort of slightly different interpretations
yes.
on it, but she's right there as one of the pioneers, I think.
Yeah.
How do you, and the things she's been writing for many years, not just recently, and saying recently, did you connect with that as well, or was it more the personal connection?
Well, it was personal, but Laura's, you're right, you're quite right. Laura was way ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. on this populism thing. And look, it got her in some trouble as it got my bosses, Robert Novak, got in a lot of trouble too with all of his conservative friends
right.
when he started sounding alarms about the Iraqi invasion
mm-hmm.
and parting company with George Bush on what the outcome would be. I will tell you full disclosure from mm-hmm. the very beginning, because I knew it would disrupt what is the cradle of Christianity, Ur. Mm-hmm. Iraq, the Chaldean population there, that is the the last ancient living community of Christianity in the Middle East, we have disrupted it and destroyed it utterly. And I had people on the ground telling me, this is bad. Saddam's a bad guy, but he allows religious freedom. He allows us to go on. He's going to leave eventually. We'll wait him out. We don't need this.
Yeah.
So that kind of informed my thinking. But they all part. That was a seismic moment, I think, among conservatives. It split the movement in many ways.
The Novak.
Bob Novak
and
Laura, Pat Buchanan, they all went off the reservation from George W. Bush at that point.
Yeah.
And that was a hard walk for Laura because she had supported the president and supported the invasion.
Yeah.
But as things played out, she was more concerned and the China, her concern about China, her concern about the American worker getting ripped off, bad trade deals, immigration. Those things were always front and center with her. And look, I like fighters. I come from strong women who are fighters, so I'm not intimidated by strong women. I like that. Stella Adler was a killer. And when I look back, all the mentors, a lot of the mentors in my life, my agent, my of course my wife, Mother Angelica, who was a fighter, Stella Adler, they were all these kind of very strong, and Laura, very strong.
Yeah.
Women, and they were willing to go out and die for what they believed. I revere that. I think that's something to be revered. And so the interesting thing about our partnership, Laura and mine, is it's not, she has a very strong point of view on these issues. I share some of that, but it's the other part of her that you don't get to see that comes out in our segment and when we're together. And it's her lighter side, her funnier side.
Exactly.
And I always thought, like anything, I don't like when a performer comes out, I don't care who you are. I don't care if it's a politician or an actor or a dancer or a singer. If you hit the same chord for an hour, that's a boring concert.
Totally agree. Yeah.
You need to mix it up.
Yeah.
Change the rhythm. Give me a higher note. Give me a lower note. Yeah. Give me something else. You need that. And we had the idea that was not warmly embraced initially that we were going to put a lighter cultural segment in the middle of the show. And everybody wanted to put it at the end of the show. And we kept saying, no. Put it in the middle of the show. It'll be a palate cleanser. Because it's not so light and frivolous that it's silly, but there's
but as you said earlier, you know, a lot of that stuff is very, very important to the things that end up being part of the political conversation.
That's exactly
they're not just sort of total fun.
It fits in the mindset that I've always had, and I think Laura shares, that culture feeds politics because it's the things we do. Jefferson talked about the manner and spirit of the people. The manner and spirit of the people. That's far more important than the policy at the end of the day, though the policy will have severe ramifications. As anyone who would have liked to take the tour of LA with me yesterday, I did a whole tour of Venice and Malibu and the homeless invasion of residential areas, the beachfront. There are policies that are now encroaching on the very people who advocated and voted for these policies. But now The consequences are on your lawn and on your doorstep, quite literally.
Yes.
And we don't like those policies.
Yes.
Well, now it's a little late to figure that out.
I know. The best example being Cher with her sort of famous tweets about the disaster that her own people have made. Well, when I heard people in sense of the Democrats. But one, just last thing I just wanted to close on, because you've mentioned it.
We're just starting.
I know. We were talking earlier about the Joe Rogan podcast, which I did once, and I thought it was going to be a 10-minute interview.
He didn't make you smoke pot or anything.
Not that.
No. Okay.
He did offer me something at the beginning. I don't know what it was.
Yes, he's very big into medicinals. We'll call them medicinals.
I thought it was good. I just arrived from the UK and I wasn't used to any of this, and I was expecting it to be a 10-minute interview, like on some radio program. 3 hours later, I'm still there talking.
Oh my God.
We're not going to be here 3 hours
later.
It really needs to be the last area I want to dive into, but it's something that you've touched on, referred to a couple of times. And I'm just curious about how you'd sort of fit it into everything, which is faith.
Yes.
That's just come up a few times in what you said. Just talk about that a little bit in terms of how that's informed your life and what you're doing now.
Well, I believe that there are only a few things that truly motivate people, and it's what you believe, principally, and the people around you, the people you're willing to give your life for, the people that you're entrusted with during this little time we have. It seems to me, and look, and I'll be honest with you, there was a period, certainly, and I think anybody's life, where you kind of drift away and you look at it askance. Mm-hmm. I was raised, you know, I was raised in a faith community. I was raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. So this was not something foreign. But you take it for granted. That's something your parents gave you rather than something you fully embrace. Mm-hmm. So there is that moment of questioning, I think, and that's healthy and good. When you look at history, when you look at great art, the art I love, the music I love, much of it comes from deeply held belief, mm-hmm. mostly religious belief, mm-hmm. Or a sense of something larger than yourself, whether it be patriotism or deep love. So I realized not only for my own well-being, which is pretty important. I mean, we're all, as Mother Angelica, who was another great mentor, used to say, a nun, a mm-hmm. very disabled nun, goes down to Alabama, builds the largest religious network in the world. She's got, you know, hundreds of millions of viewers. She used to say, at the end of the day, we all drag our own carcasses to market. And that's correct. That's it. We drag our own carcasses to market at the end of the day. We're accountable for all this stuff we do here.
Yeah.
So that's important. And that wellspring of faith, and the more I read, the more I think of the founding fathers of this country, they did say this Constitution was meant for a moral people. And I often reflect on what that means today. When you do have religious faith ebbing, a unity of even a core basic American principles are up for grabs, what does that mean? And does this Constitution mm-hmm. still, is it still operable with these people? So the faith is still very important. It's always the last thing to die and the first obituary written.
Right.
Everybody always says, oh, faith, it's over. It's over. And then, of course, you know, one little flower crops up and then the forest is there.
And as you know, I was just talking to a friend here in Los Angeles the other week, and they were telling me about a new church that's mm. growing up in LA, young mm. millennials uh-huh. getting into faith in their own way. It's very, you know,
they're searching. The they're kind searching.
Of thing. And it's just, but Christianity, you know, not some, you know, absolutely yeah. part of the.
Sure.
of the mainstream, mm-hmm. but done in a particular way yeah. that suits them, the mm-hmm. kinds of meetings and gatherings and mm-hmm. so on. That
the home churches,
them, it's look really
at home churches. And I mean, Americans are by and large a faithful people. I mean, it's certainly got the largest per capita and percentage yeah. of people of faith of anywhere in the world. I mean, we are a faithful people. And I think that's a good thing and something that should be appreciated and nurtured. It's good for the republic and the community to have, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. even if you don't believe it, it's good that someone does.
Yeah, because I think that's right.
Because as my friend Richard John Newhouse, a great intellectual, political, you know, visionary and a man of faith, a priest, he used to say, politics is a functionary of culture, mm-hmm. and culture is an outspring of morality, and mm-hmm. morality mm-hmm. finds its impetus in faith, religious faith. You need that to sustain the other, or it will crumble. So for all of that, I mean,
there you are.
Well, I think personal, that's, it's important.
I agree. And I think we're going to leave it there. You've been a very faithful guest. I really appreciate all those thoughts. Lots to think about. What an interesting life.
Thank you.
And just getting started.
Just getting started, Steve Hilton.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, in these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.